Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Now, Dr. Rahi Victory is an obstetrician, a gynaecologist and infertility specialist dedicated to helping improve the reproductive health of men and women. He's actively involved in fertility research and runs a multidisciplinary clinic in Canada. He's joining the panel discussion on endometriosis at the Future of Fertility show in the RDS in Dublin this weekend, and he joins me on the line now. Rahi, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honoured to be here.
I feel like before we get into the interview, I need to just preempt with a bit of a trigger warning for people, because I think any kind of discussion around fertility, infertility can be very triggering for people. I'm very conscious as I moderate the panels at the weekend that I have that at the forefront of my mind. And I don't need to tell you that, because you're meeting people and couples at the very centre of it all the time. So everything we do say here is with the idea of giving people information. There's no judgment in anything I or Dr. Rahi is going to say. Am I okay to say that on your behalf, Dr. Rahi?
Oh, of course. And I think that's wonderful sensitivity. So I think that's a great message to send out to everyone.
So before we get into the work that you do, where are we with global fertility rates?
Well, global fertility rates are unfortunately quite disastrous, to be honest. Unfortunately, the majority of countries are either below or substantially below their replacement rate for the population. And so fertility globally is really in decline for a variety of reasons. And we know that by 2050, the anticipation is that about 50% of countries will fall below the population replacement rate. By 2100, they anticipate that 97% of countries will fall below the population replacement rate. And interestingly, the 3% that will still have their population replacement rate be adequate are all actually in the continent of Africa. So I think developed nations are facing a real crisis in the future.
And do we know why that is?
Well, I think there's a variety of different reasons. So on the male side, sperm quality is declining, most likely in large part because of exposure, smoking, drinking, drug use, obesity, high cholesterol, bad diets, many, many different factors, environmental exposures, plastics, chemicals, and so on. On the female side, the predominant driver is age. So many women entering the workforce are delaying their childbearing, and as a result, their fertility just naturally declines. And so that is probably the largest element for the female component. But there are, again, the same factors, the dietary habits, the lifestyle, the obesity, smoking, drinking, drug use, which seem to be growing in prevalence. All of these have a very negative impact on the outcomes. And so it can be very, very significant in terms of how easy it is to conceive later in life.
You have a particularly revolutionary approach to reproductive health at your clinic and infertility. And it almost blows my mind that it's considered to be revolutionary and in some circles almost a maverick approach, in that you give individualized patient-centered care rather than always suggesting IVF. Can you explain a little bit about how you conduct your clinic and work?
Sure. So I'm sorry to hear that we all feel it's maverick. I wish that this was the standard of care, but I think patients need to realize, and of course physicians as well, that all IVF patients, or all fertility patients, I should say, deserve to know what is wrong first. So they have to be educated initially, and then they need to have a lot of options offered to them. It is a very rare circumstance in which someone doesn't actually have options, whether you're male factor, female factor, or both. There are almost always going to be numerous options available to those individuals. And so the key is to actually outline what those options are, allow the patients to make a decision based on their wants, their needs, and the information that you've provided them. Unfortunately, in our modern fertility world, a lot of it is driven by big business. The businesses have a financial goal in mind, and so the care of the patient is often either lost or demoted in importance. And so as a result of that, people are sort of herded or pushed on, as you mentioned it, that sort of pathway or assembly line into IVF. And that's both unfair and in many cases unnecessary. So what we do is we educate our patients on what's wrong with them first, and then we explain that they can do this, that, or the other thing, whatever those may be. And then we allow them to make a conscious decision and decide how they want to proceed.
And I suppose this is not to demonize IVF. What an incredible step within science and medicine that has allowed countless people across the world to become parents. But it's about arming people with the right information, as you said. Does it come down to timing sometimes for people, that biological clock ticking and the fact that making small, sustainable dietary, lifestyle and other measures may take more time than people feel they have?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. I mean, there's certainly the time concern where people want, let's say, two or three children. And if they're in their later 30s, that might be difficult or impossible if you're taking a natural approach. So again, when we talk about options with people, we're not eliminating IVF. IVF is an amazing tool. I do it frequently, and I think it's a very valuable and important part of the armamentarium of tools that we have to take care of this problem of infertility. But at the same time, the critical element is not everybody needs it. And so you really have to individualize for each patient. As an example, if a woman is 38 and she wants three children, a natural approach is likely going to be very difficult if she's already struggling with infertility, because we know it's going to take some time to get her to conceive. After she has one baby, now she's probably closer to 39 or 40. By the time she comes back for another baby, it's going to be another year or so. So now we're up into 41. And then by the time she has that baby, we're really looking at 42, 43, 44, when she's ready to conceive again, at which point it's extremely difficult. So in those cases, IVF is a great option. Conversely, if you have someone that's 28 and the only problem is that she's not regular with her cycles, which is very common, those patients don't need IVF. They can simply take some medication and they'll be fine.
What about those that are given the diagnosis of unexplained infertility?
Well, unexplained infertility is sort of a catchphrase that we as physicians have learned to use to explain that we don't know what's going on. So unfortunately, in those cases, or in many of those cases, it's not so much that it's unexplained, it's that we haven't got an answer for the patients. The answers are often there. You just need to dig deeper. So as an example, 44% of patients with unexplained infertility actually have endometriosis in the woman. And so that's something that's easy to find. A simple, very benign surgical procedure like laparoscopy can define it and treat it at the same time. Many of those patients have problems with their uterine or vaginal microbiome or have immunologically mediated infertility where their immune systems either don't agree with their partner's proteins or are just over-aggressive, so it's kind of attacking the embryo. And so those patients can get answers in many of the instances that we are calling unexplained. It just requires your doctor to be having the willingness, and the patient, of course, to have the willingness to say, let's look deeper into this. Let's find you the answers you need.
You mentioned endometriosis there, and obviously, you know, in the confines of answering a question to a radio interview, you said it as succinctly as possible, but you also made it sound quite simple, whereas the reality of women's experience with endometriosis can be waiting up to 9 years to even get that diagnosis. Why do we have that time lag? Why is it so difficult for women to have endometriosis diagnosed and treated?
Well, that's a fantastic question. So it comes from two aspects. On the one hand, many women are either taught or sort of socially cultured to not complain. So their periods may be terrible. They may have difficulty with intercourse. They may have very heavy periods, painful periods, but they just don't talk about it. They're not bringing it up to their GPs or to their specialists. And so, I mean, if we don't know about it, we can't deal with it. On the other hand, physicians are just absolutely wretched about acknowledging that it's not normal to have very painful periods. and that it does merit investigation and that we need to actually listen to our patients when they're talking to us. So a lot of it comes from not necessarily gaslighting, which I see all the time, although that sometimes may be the case, but a lot of it just comes from physicians downplaying the symptoms of the patient because they feel that it's normal for a woman to have pain. And really, it can be an element of menstruation, but severe pain, severe discomfort, painful intimacy, all these things are not necessarily normal. And they definitely need to set off alarm bells in the physician's head to say, could this be endometriosis? Do I need to investigate this further? The actual investigation itself is very simple, but getting people to the point where they're willing to acknowledge that is not. The other thing, which I may sound very cynical, and I apologize if I do, but there's a big financial push to get people to do IVF. It's an enormous push. A lot of IVF is now owned by venture capital funds, private equity funds, and you know, many of them want to help patients, but they want to do it in the process of making a lot of money doing so. And when that occurs, there is this enormous drive to just get people to doing IVF, that conveyor belt you mentioned earlier. And the reality is that when you're on that conveyor belt, getting off the conveyor belt for a probably pretty long time to deal with endometriosis slows that process down and is a failure of getting income for those companies. So they're not looking for solutions that don't profit them. And that's kind of pushing away a lot of great options like surgery or treatment for endo that could otherwise make a critical difference for the patient.
And the impact that that has on those patients is so far reaching. The stories you hear of people on endless cycles, putting themselves in debt and feeling like they have failed, that their bodies have failed them. It's a traumatic experience for people involved. And to think that it's not just an unfortunate turn of events, that it's based on a profit mindset, I mean, it would really make your blood boil.
It really does. It certainly does mine. I mean, depending on what structure or what model your clinic has, if the physician is working for a company, in particular, venture capital or private equity, you know, there are stories that are published in Bloomberg where one particular clinic in the U.S., a whole chain, was throwing out the doctors that weren't doing enough IVF cycles. They were mandating how much IVF you had to do. And so you're not practicing medicine at that point. You're just an employee being told what to do and how many times to do it. So it very much depends on who owns the business or the clinic. And I'm personally of the mindset that it shouldn't be owned by non-physicians. I think physicians have a duty to their patients. And I think that our goal is to provide care. And when you enter business into it, it really gums up the works and makes it a very complicated mess where now you have other interests that are competing ahead of, in many cases, the care of the patient.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I mentioned at the introduction that you're actively involved in fertility research, but you've also come across people, fellow physicians within the industry, who are resistant to take on board the medical science and what it says.
Very much so. So there's a great reluctance within the fertility community to change. I think as a general rule, many physicians are somewhat reluctant to change. We spend a lot of time and hours and sleepless nights getting to where we are. And once you're there, there's this, okay, I made it sort of scenario. And physicians are not want to make changes or have to continue delving into the research and the study and the time it takes to stay at the top of the game and to be the best that there is. So there's a huge, huge reluctance to change or to improvement. They basically figure, look, I know what I'm doing. I'm getting a reasonable success rate. Why would I want to go from having a 40% success rate to a 50% success rate? I'm perfectly fine at my 40. Why should I change? Whereas for us, I'm not satisfied until I get to 100. So, you know, I think we're not going to get there, but I'm never going to stop trying.
Yeah, because these aren't just stats and percentages. These are people. These are real lives. And that's supposed to be, as you say, at the centre of why somebody becomes a physician or studies medicine in the first place. I am conscious that it's important to use this platform and to shine a light and have difficult conversations like this. But I'm also very conscious of the people I mentioned at the start of the interview who are on an infertility journey or having issues with their reproductive health. And this may further confuse them and upset them and make them think that they can't trust the clinic that they're going to, or, you know, that the whole game is rigged. What's your advice to people at the centre of all of this?
Well, I hate to be cynical, but it can be rigged. So I think patients do need to be very careful in the selections and the choices that they're making. You need to know the motivations of your doctor. You need to find someone that is going to explain to you and educate you about what's wrong. And then they're going to offer you options, and they're going to educate you about those options too. So they're going to tell you, you can try, for example, natural, and here's how we would do that, and here's the outcome you can anticipate. Or you can try IVF, and here's how we're going to do that, and here's the outcome you can expect, and here's the cost you should expect as well. And here's how many times it's going to take you, because you can tell people to do IVF, but if you know in advance that on average it's going to take them 3 tries, patients deserve to have that knowledge in advance instead of just try IVF and then it doesn't work and they say just try again. Well, patients deserve to know that ahead of time. And I think that the biggest, most critical element for all patients is that they need to find a team, the doctor, the nurses, the clinic, that they trust. If you've got trust with your doctor, we're going to achieve amazing things for you. And if you don't, it's just a horrible, rocky ride that never brings satisfaction. Even if you have a baby, it's often such a traumatic experience that it's really harmful to the patients.
Well, I feel like this is a massive conversation that we've perhaps only scratched the surface on, but I'm glad that we have, and I'm glad that there are doctors like you working in this area. We will have to leave it there for today. But for more on the work of Dr. Rahi Victory, you can go to drvictory.com, and you can also go to futurefertilityshow.com. Dr. Rahi, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to meeting everyone in Ireland shortly.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.